This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Well, good evening, everybody. This is Nate G, along with Dr. Doug Lyle, with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good, good. Good to see you again.
Excellent. Okay, today's show is called What Will the Future Look Like? And I titled it What Will the Future Look Like? Because a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Lyle, you and I were talking on the phone, and I just casually asked you, well, what do you think the, you know, what will human life look like in 1,000 years? And as you do, I was hoping that you'd say that life is going to be grand and we're going to have all these innovations. And you did say that. You explained a lot of really fun stuff, and I've been fascinated ever since about what you think the future will look like. And I was a little disappointed because I thought, man, where were you when the dot-com bubble was bursting, and where were you when Yahoo and Google and all those places were taken off? So we're going to talk about that.
Well.
We're going to, yeah. Oh well.
Broke with no money to invest. Oh well, such is life. All right.
Or as you could have told, yeah. But we're gonna talk over an article that one of our listeners sent us called. It's called "The Rise of the Bromance: Threatening Heterosexual Relationships." Warn social scientists. And then we're going to go over a question from one of our listeners about the primary goal of humans and what our next evolution will look like. Now, before we go to that, we have a caller who's been on hold. This is Dan from New Hampshire. So Dan, welcome to the show. You're on with Dr. Lyle.
Hey, how's it going? First of all, I love the podcast. And cool. Dr. Lyle, I love the Pleasure Trap. Literally changed my life. That was exactly what I needed at the time that I picked it up. So I'm honored to be talking to you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Absolutely. All right. What's up, and what are we working on? What are we trying to get better?
Yeah. So I'm glad that I was able to find your take and, you know, everything discussed on this podcast and how it's rooted in science and evolutionary psychology, and it's a lot more rigid and, you know, tangible than some of the self-development type stuff I'd got myself wrapped up into for a couple of years before that. And so that said, I was actually kind of mired in some struggles with not only like drugs or anything, but like a binge eating disorder and a porn addiction. And it was just kind of a mess. And I think in large part from understanding the way you explained the dynamics of addiction and all that, I've got myself out of that, but now I'm kind of wondering, you know, I know this podcast is called Beat Your Genes and not just adhere to your genes. And I was curious to know if you had any thoughts on basically, I'm a very like creative artistic guy. And I think I'm very talented specifically musically. And I know, you know, biologically, the purpose of life is just gene replication, as you've explained it. But I'm finding that I'm kind of, you know, a ship without a breeze in the ocean here. Like, now that I've kind of got some of my basics covered, if the purpose of life was just to reproduce and it wasn't to do anything grand with your passions and your creative pursuits, do you have a stance on that? Like, which direction you should head?
Yeah, let's talk about this. The concept here is that the biological purpose of life is to reproduce genes, and so it's through that lens that we can understand both the physical and psychological architecture of all animals, including humans. So we essentially, what we do is we can look at human behavior, and, you know, i.e. the motivations behind it and the feelings that accompany it, and we can reverse engineer why those features happen to exist inside this species as opposed to other features. So instead of being fascinated with eucalyptus leaves, which we're not, the way a koala bear is, we know that if we're not fascinated with them, it's probably not part and parcel of human evolutionary history. Now, so we have to keep two separate issues in mind. What we're trying to do here is we're trying to enjoy the daylights out of your existence. We face mortality with our eyes wide open, and we realize that in all probability, there isn't anything after this. This is all the time you've got. You don't know how much time there is. And we're not going to get caught in a trap of trying to do something, quote, lasting, because that's a joke. It's not lasting, and nobody cares. And so you don't want to have spent your life trying to be so outstanding at some great deed that they have a statue of you in a park somewhere in Spain and 2 centuries from now and some birds crapping on the top of that statue. We don't care. Okay? Now, so we're not going to fall for a trap that I call the hill climbing trap of trying to do something so grand that the whole world knows your name and that they're bowing down to your legacy, you know, in the village 100 years from now. Who cares? Our focus should be on the present and the context of your life and the emotions that flow through your nervous system between now and the day you die. So our job is to enjoy this existence. Now, question is, how do we do it? And the answer to that question is going to be complicated, and it's going to have a few principles that are worth being aware of. And one of those is that your engineering is going to be part and parcel of this, in the sense that many of the things, the way you were engineered to enjoy things is largely the fact that if you did those things with gusto, they resulted in more genes being reproduced. So when you have a feeling about wanting to do something grand and do something brilliantly well, there's nothing in principle wrong with that. And in fact, it's part of your design. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to actually figure out an ecological niche in the marketplace of human enjoyments and human values. In other words, people enjoy arts, they enjoy dancing and singing and storytelling and et cetera. New art form in early 20th century was movies. And so they're going to there's certain things that human beings enjoy, and they also not surprisingly people enjoy creating them. So they are not only consumers of these arts, they are also producers of the arts, and they like both sides of it. Now, you tend to like things mercifully, where you are relatively strong at them. That's partially because you get good feedback from other people about it, and you tend to be disinterested in things that you are that you are pathetic at. Okay, so relative to other people, that isn't always true, but it tends to be the case because you're designed by nature to be partly interested. Part of your excitement about anything is the fact that unbeknownst to you, there's little neural connections down deep in your soul about anything that are connected to the survival and reproductive benefits that you are apparently accruing when you are pursuing these things. So if you're pretty good at drawing pictures and the girls in the sixth grade are oohing and aahing at your drawing ability, then that's you probably like to draw anyway. And now you're going to keep drawing and keep drawing and keep drawing as long as they're oohing and aahing. And a few years from now, if they start taking their clothes off, you may be drawing until your last day on earth. Okay. So the point here is that you weren't designed to be thinking and worrying particularly. You're not designed to be thinking about your reproductive success. You're designed actually, you certainly think about sex and plot and plan you're not really thinking about reproduction particularly, you're thinking about sex. However, you are also designed to enjoy the competitive processes of producing displays that the opposite sex in particular, or even other people, same sex, would find fascinating, awe-inspiring, and admirable. So it isn't that we say, well, gee, what's the point of this whole thing anyway? It's just a bunch of genes, and then it's sitting in a vehicle, and it dies. No, there's no existential crisis here. What we have here is a very interesting challenge. And the challenge is, now that we know how the game is wired up, we actually know its purpose. Our job now is to say, fine, okay, probably as a result of that being the purpose, there's probably some traps in it. And so we're going to try to avoid the traps while we actually harvest the potential that sits inside the organism for enjoyment. Our job is to look at your nervous system like an extraordinary board game, a video game. And our job is to actually hit those circuits brilliantly to try to have an optimal life experience. Now, most people will just follow their instincts. In fact, that's all they will do is follow their instincts. And that's fine, no problem. And depending upon what set of cards life deals to them, they will pretty much do a so-so job of playing those cards. So if some guy is average attractive, average smart, lives in an average town, he'll probably wind up with an average job and an average wife and an average pair of kids and an average life experience. And if it turns out that he's in, you know, the Sudan, it's going to be lousy because that's a bad set of circumstances for this particular ape. But if it turns out that he's in San Diego, he's probably going to have a pretty decent life, not bad. Now, our job is to take that life, which would be at the 50th percentile for the general population's, you know, abilities and experience there in the United States, and we're going to try to move the needle north. And so we're going to try to actually behave smarter, and we're going to try to do things in such a way that we have a greater life experience. One of the life characteristics of a human life experience that will make it excellent is something that you made mention of this when you're describing a little bit of your sort of puzzlement about what this all means. The truth of the matter is, one of the really cool things to do is to take the gloves off, roll up your shirt sleeves, and really take a run at doing things just as well as you could possibly do them, to try to do a really great job, okay? Why? Well, for one thing, is that your own internal audience is watching your efforts, and it's watching how hard you're, how well and how diligently you are actually pursuing some competitive processes. And those competitive processes have to do with you trying to do things that the village is going to find valuable. Now, that may be frivolous, i.e., you're going to be an actor in, I don't know, The Road to Rio, you know, whatever it is. So that could be that, or you could be trying to find the cure for cancer. But whatever it is, you're trying to compete with other people that are trying to do that same, hit that those same human values and that same basic socio-ecological niche, and so they have the similar tasks that you have, and there's nothing in the world wrong with, and in fact there's much right about the idea of pursuing excellence and trying to do a superb job. Now, what we're not going to do is we're not going to try to be a world champion, not unless that comes with unbelievable benefits and comes easily enough to us. But it just so happens to be a side effect of us doing something very well at a pace and with an amount of our life budget that makes sense. The reason why we want to keep things like this budget in budgets, or what I'd call in balance, is because it would be, for example, if your next door neighbor had an organic strawberry farm and they would keep coming over and bringing you strawberries, they could be really, really good. But the thing is, you only want about four or five of them a day. Then after that, you don't really like them that well. And it's really not that great eating 25 of these things a day. They start taking up the space and displacing the fact that there's other foods that you don't like as well as strawberries, but you like them better than strawberries after you've had seven or eight strawberries. And that's the same thing that can happen with dedicated, driven human achievement, where we're trying to do something outstanding. The point is that if we get caught up in the outcomes, the competitive process of trying to do something spectacular and world earth-shattering or anything else, the problem is it's very easy to get life out of balance and then to be disappointed when we fall short because we didn't get the outcome, etc. So what we're trying to do here instead, more than focus on the outcome, is I want people to focus on the process. I want them to pursue the excellence behind the motivation of watching their self-esteem mechanism activate the pride circuits that comes with knowing that they dug in and that they did an excellent job at what it is that they were attempting to do. The reason why they were doing it was ultimately for some competitive processes and that they wanted to get recognition and heterosexual chips and cachet and money and other things that would come with excellence. That's fine. But we also have to keep such pursuits in balance, or else the genes have beat us. And the desire to get to those outcomes has sitting inside of a competitive landscape that is very, very difficult to get to the top of any dominance hierarchy in the world today, or anywhere close to the top of a dominance hierarchy, without unbelievable, phenomenal commitment where it's way out of balance. Okay? So if you want to be the chief of thoracic surgery at, you know, Stanford, good luck to you. You're going to have to dedicate your life to getting to the top of that little dominance hierarchy, and you're going to have essentially no communication with your wife or husband, as however that works, not much communication with your children, and you're going to not be able to play golf and enjoy that, i.e. all the other grapes and grapefruit and bananas and everything else that you would want to have for breakfast, because all you're going to be eating is strawberries, nothing else, okay? So I would encourage you to look at this life as an adventure and to have the notion that when you have things that spark your interest where you might have relative strengths, that you could pursue those strengths and actually achieve some interesting things, some things that might be really remarkable. They could even be timeless. Okay, you might trip over and be part of or do something like Casablanca that 80 years later you look at that thing and it's still incredible. But the point is, what we want to focus rather than on the externals of what the achievements could bring, what we want to do instead is focus on how much we're enjoying the process as it goes. And that's where we're trying to beat our genes, with the process rather than the outcome. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, that was really insightful. Thank you.
Good, good. Okay. All right.
Cool.
Thank you. Other questions that come up about that? Or is that directing that discussion in the way that you needed it?
Yeah, for sure. I had some things I wanted to ask, but I mean, that was the main crux of it.
Yes.
I mean, just one quick follow-up.
Sure.
I know I did mention that I do music. It's kind of a dichotomous situation that I found myself in, where I do a lot with, like, singer-songwriter work, where I do guitar, piano, singing, all that type of stuff. And then I also do hip-hop with, like, rapping and real, like, hardcore lyrics and everything, and they're a lot different from each other. And I find that I just happen to be in a position where I could make some contacts locally to some pretty important people in the hip hop game, and it's something I like doing. And I think I'm equally skilled at either of those, you know, different genres. But I think the singer songwriter stuff is more of who I am. But
said, this hip-hop stuff, I see as yielding an easier, you know, means into that lifestyle that I want with, like, you know, give me more heterosexual chips, as you were saying. And I found myself struggling to choose which I would rather, you know what I mean?
Okay. The in general, I would look at this thing as a this is where you want to, in some ways, follow your nose and not be afraid to make a mistake. So if there's opportunities that could close with your hip-hop issue, for example, that if there's a set of social dynamics that are taking place that the singer-songwriter will never close. You could be a singer-songwriter when you're 83. Just ask Joni Mitchell. Okay, so the but if there's a set of social dynamics that open a window of something that's interesting and fun and could be lucrative, et cetera, then there's really no reason not to be open to that experience and see where it leads. If it leads to more or less nowhere in 6 or 8 months or a year or something or however long it lasts, then the other avenue is never going to leave you. It's always there. So yeah, there's nothing in the world. What's your age?
26.
Yeah. This is a time of life to take big chances and to expand your horizons, do wacky things, essentially try to do things that are far outside the box, that, you know, things that you probably won't be doing when you're 46. Because what you want to do is you want to essentially, if you have a little cockroach that's trying to optimize his behavior in a square meter of territory, if that little cockroach stays within that square meter and just lives its whole life there, it's going to be really good at knowing every little bump and every little hole and every little aphid that lives in that square meter. But it won't have necessarily optimized its life experience, because it might have been smarter to actually go 3 meters by 3 meters and to walk all over a landscape that's 9 square meters instead of 1 square meter and spend half your life figuring out what on earth the landscape looks like, and then have the second half of life basically honed in on this is the place of the landscape where I'm going to live, okay? And this is what it is that I'm going to do, because now I've surveyed the landscape. So when you're in your 20s, you are absolutely still surveying the landscape. And my attitude would be bold and adventurous at that time in your life, and expand your landscape, expand your horizons, and just be a sponge to soak up and learn and experience. There's plenty of time to pull in your horizons closer to you later, after you know, you know, this is me, this is what I want to do. I'm now much more certain of that, and I'm willing to essentially get more focused and less broad. So that's how I look at that.
Okay, cool.
Okay.
Yeah, that's awesome. And yeah, and I think that's definitely a thing I find myself struggling with too, is not wanting to cut bait with all the different pursuits, the singer-songwriter, the hip-hop. I'm also really into fitness and have been spending some of my time trying to learn about that so that I could be a personal trainer. And then I'm trying to learn videography and photography. And it kind of harkens back to something I learned in a book about meditation, actually, which was, you know, we are monotasking kind of creatures. And if you try to pursue many things at once, you're probably just going to do a mediocre job at all of them instead of honing in on one and doing a really great job at it. And it's just, I'm finding it hard to cut bait with any one of those things in case it's the wrong thing to cut bait with. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And my attitude towards this is to, like I said, at 26 and for a while into the future, the way to be is to not be worried about honing in and achieving your optimum capabilities in some narrow domain. That for all we know, what will percolate inside that head are potentially, you need cross-pollinization to to different kinds of goals where you're learning different kinds of things as long as they're interesting. And so there is no way for you to know what you may be learning as you follow your own gut into things that, that are interesting about how this comes together for you 5 years from now or 10 years from now in a unique solution, in a unique you know, amalgam of little bits that come together in some new kind of goal or interesting thing. So yeah, I'm never up for young people getting very narrow and focused. If they happen to be that way personality-wise, and it turns out that by God, ever since they were, you know, 13 years old, they want to be an anesthesiologist, then go for it, kid. But yeah, there's a very good chance, and that you sound, you know, more adventurous and right-brained and varied interests, this is fine. And so keep your eyes open, keep your horizons wide, and continue to learn, and then you let events and demands and the internal sense of a need for balance and shifting of resources and time and attention, you let that dictate the flow, but don't be shutting down horizons really for any other reason than it makes sense and that you need to. Okay?
Yeah. All right, cool.
Okay.
I really
all
appreciate
right.
that and you know, all the work that you've done, and I can't say it enough. I'm so thankful for the pleasure trap in this podcast. So I'm happy you
very
guys
cool.
keep doing it every week.
Great.
Excellent.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks,
yeah,
Dan,
thank
very
you,
much for the call. And as any listeners listening, the title of the show is a little bit different than the topic we took, but that's not a problem. That's what we're here for. Callers will always take priority over the topic that I named the show on. It can always be changed. So we've got no problem with that. Speaking of
all
which,
right.
Dr. Lyle, we've got another caller on hold, so we're going to take this call here.
Okay.
Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Stephen. I'm calling from Ohio.
Got
hey,
it.
Stephen, welcome
okay.
to the show.
Thanks.
Fire when ready.
All right. What's up, Stephen? What's going on?
Oh, yeah. My question was kind of like a two-part question. The first part is, do you think I hear a lot, you know, that leaders are made and not born, and I want to know your thoughts on that. And then also your thoughts on the growth mindset, the Carol Dweck stuff, like the fixed mindset versus growth mindset. Because I know you guys, it's
yeah.
typically nature versus nurture on the show, and I just wanted to get your perspective.
Right. Very good questions. Okay, so the first thing about leaders being born or made, let's back up and take a first pass at what it is that anybody's speculating about and what they're thinking. If you strip this down, what you're really asking is, you know, is leadership a skill or is it a personality? And the truth is it's going to be some of both. Okay, it's mostly going to be personality. So it's going to be mostly born. And so that question has been asked through the centuries, and until recently, unless you are informed by a subsection of psychology that we call behavior genetics. So unless if you've listened to this podcast or you have somehow miraculously landed in a university class where the professor actually knows the facts and has the guts to say what they are. If you actually know that, then you know that the human personality is dominated by individual differences in people, is dominated by the genetics, by their genetics rather than their upbringing. Now, so that being the case, we would understand that to the extent that the demands of leadership are associated with or excellence in leadership is going to be associated with personality traits, then to that extent, that issue is going to be genetics. So genetics, and it's going to turn out that leadership issues are going to be standard human dynamics issues, and so therefore genetics are going to dominate the show absolutely. Now, that doesn't mean that would also be very much akin to the following, that genetics dominate athletics. Without a doubt. So when they look and try to select draft choices in the NBA, they want to see what the person's span is from fingertip to fingertip. They want to see how high the person can jump. They want to see how fast they can run 60 feet, et cetera. So they have a bunch of objective parameters that are in general, and they also want to know how strong they are and what their height and their weight is and their age. And they've got, like, you know, pretty soon they're going to be able to assay the people's genes and just find out. But the bottom line is what they are looking for is genetic parameters. They know that those genetic parameters are extremely predictive of people's success at that sport. Now, they also want to know some other things, like how good is the guy at pick and roll, okay? What are his ball handling skills? Now, these things are much more learned. And so this has to do with whether or not the person has the specific skills. You could have one whale of an athlete, but the guy's never picked up a basketball. He's been playing soccer in Ethiopia, okay? So as a result, you might look at the guy and you're like, oh, my God, you'd be a fantastic basketball specimen. What are you doing playing soccer in Ethiopia? Now, so the point is that you also have to assess the skills of the specific problem that specific market niche is seeking. So you could have a great leader, but the guy doesn't know anything about building refrigerators. So you can't put him in charge of a refrigerator building, you know, plant, okay? That's not going to work very well. But the point is that the particulars of any issue, you know, given the fact that the particular knowledge demands with respect to any leadership issue are some X amount of information, and that X amount of information can be learned in X amount of time. The question is, who do you pick to do the leadership? And the answer is, you're going to be picking by genetics. So in that way, leaders are born, they're not made. There's people, we can see even from experiments done by McGargy all the way back in the 1960s, that within less than a minute, most human dyads will very quickly determine a dominant and submissive human. And those things tend to be stable. So the two people meet, they just shake hands, they start chit-chatting. They don't even know they're doing it, but they're figuring out who's the follower and who's the leader just that fast. Okay, so the answer to the age-old question, are leaders born or made? The answer is leaders are absolutely born, but they have to be made to the extent that they have to have the requisite background in the details of the area of which that they're leading. So you don't put a brilliant CEO in charge of a platoon that's going to try to take, you know, Bunker Hill. That's not what you do. But if you gave that guy 2 years in the military so that he knew enough about military strategy and et cetera, then that's exactly who you would put charging Bunker Hill. Make sense?
Yeah. In my job, you know, they're always doing, like, leadership development stuff. And I was just wondering about that after listening to your show. Like is there any point in trying to be a better leader if I'm not, like, a natural leader?
Yeah. So, if you're not a natural leader, then this is a total waste of time. So the
okay.
If you get stuck in leadership issues, then there's little skills that you can do to make your leadership ability better in some ways. But, you know, if it's not in the genes, then there's no point in hoping that someday this person's going to be some great leader, because it's not going to happen.
Okay. Cool.
Okay. All right. You had a second question. I forgot what it was. Oh, it was about mindset.
My other question.
Yeah, it was about mindset. Carol Dweck.
For six mindset. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Dweck's research, just to fill people in that are listening, is this notion that, for example, if you take children and you have them and you tell them, I have them working at some math problems, and then they get done and you say, well, you really made a really good effort. That was an excellent effort. Then it's going to turn out that when you give them some more math problems, they're going to work very hard at those math problems. This is what she calls a growth mindset. If you take that kid's set of answers and you say, wow, you're really brilliant. You're fantastic at math. If you then give them a set of new math problems that are maybe a little tiny bit tougher, they won't try. And they will not want to do it. If you say, would you like to try these? You know, you don't have to, but if you'd like to, they won't do it. And the answer for the reason that she gives is this is what they have called, what she's going to say, that's called a fixed mindset. In other words, we've given them a mindset that you have a certain level of abilities versus you have a flexible type of abilities that could grow. Now, Dweck actually does not understand the dynamic of her own studies. These studies are interesting. They're actually very interesting. And they always work because she has identified a dynamic accurately. In other words, it is, but she's incorrectly understanding that this is a, quote, mindset and that it's either fixed or growth mindset. What she's identified is what I have talked about is called the ego trap. And so in order to understand that, you have to understand quite a bit more about psychology than Dweck is actually bringing to the table here. So you have to understand that human beings are designed to seek esteem, and that if you give them cues that they have been given more esteem than they believe that they deserve, then this causes a cost-benefit analysis to tell that informs them that they are better off not trying something that it looks like they might not be able to do. And so this stops their motivation. So essentially, you need to understand that all motivation of all animals is being run through a cost-benefit set of algorithms, all ultimately mathematically associated with what's known as Hamilton's rule. So this is all being derived by the cost-benefit that's involved here is all being directly related to what we're going to call gene survival. So this, just to pound the point home, Dweck doesn't know any of this. So Dweck has correctly identified a dynamic in human motivation, but actually has no idea why it exists. So this is so mindset is a cool thing to read. If you read 50 or 60 pages of it, it will then soon become repetitive. She even at one point says, oh, this is all about ego, and you got to stop that. She actually doesn't know what it is, and she's essentially lecturing people and saying, don't do this to these kids, don't do it to yourself, don't do it to your friends. She's recognizing that this issue of, she calls it fixed mindset, but actually what it is it's over-rewarding people with esteem above the level of their belief in what it is that they could be capable of doing. So it turns out that if you gave, quote, what she would call fixed mindset feedback to people where it was actually below the level of what it is that they're capable of doing, it wouldn't stop their motivation at all. They would actually be insulted if you then gave them a bunch of easy math problems and said, yeah, do you want to do those? They would. Okay? It would have to be where the inference was we had over-rewarded them with status for the ability. Then they would stop behind the cost-benefit analysis. So this, I have articulated this on my website at esteemdynamics.com and also on this podcast. That's actually the dynamic that Dweck has identified, and her empirical work is excellent, and it's a pure, beautiful one demonstration after the next of exactly what we've analyzed here. Okay?
Okay.
Very good.
Thanks, guys, for calling the show.
Excellent.
Yeah, thank you very much for the call. Wants to listen to that audio clip, it's at esteemdynamics.org. All right, so let's see. We're 35 minutes in.
We're talking about the future.
The future,
yeah.
Do you want to table that and just do a show with it next week? I don't know if we want to try to cover the future in 10 minutes.
Yeah, maybe not. Do we have any other – we got any lurking questions around?
Yeah, let me pull a couple up. I take a look at everybody's questions, and in this particular case, we had a couple of questions that struck my fancy about the future, so I put them in. So let's see. Actually, this is a really funny little show somebody sent me a few hours ago. The staff at the other show called This American Life, it's a national broadcast, it's a national radio show, like a podcast. And what they did was they all had their testosterone measured.
Yeah.
And then they decided to, before they got the results, they were going to rate each other who they thought had more testosterone than everybody else. And it was, you know, half girls, half guys. It was a really, really interesting thought. And this listener wanted to know if you could listen to it and then respond to it. So I'll send it to you and see if you can listen to it. But the results were actually pretty funny. It was really, really interesting to see how they were quite accurate on the females. But there was a gay guy who they thought he'd have the lowest because he's gay. And there was another guy who got into a lot of fights and played a lot of sports. And they thought he'd have the highest testosterone, but it turns out it was the complete opposite. The gay guy had the highest, like twice more than the next level, the next guy.
Yeah.
And the guy who got in a lot of fights.
Right. Yeah. So we're going to, so it's not going to be so simple as just measuring levels within a population. The, it's going to turn out that these are going to be statistically useful if we're looking at a lot of people in large numbers, but it's going to be only a fairly modest correlation coefficient measuring in between. We're going to find probably, and this is probably quite easy to demonstrate and is probably true, is that within a subject, if you did something to raise that person's testosterone level, you would see it in their behavior. Okay?
Oh, I see
so
what you're saying.
That's how that's going to work. So the general, this is like cholesterol levels. You could run very high cholesterol levels and be extremely healthy because you just might run high cholesterol levels. But if your cholesterol levels raise substantially, the way that that would have happened is you started eating a lot more animal food, and now we're going to start to see, you know, we could start to see evidence of, you know, cardiovascular distress. So that's how that's going to work. So just because there's a lot of people out there that thinking that their cholesterols are 140 and that they're safe, they're not even remotely safe. Your cholesterol level could be quite low, and yet that's just because that's you naturally run cholesterol low, but you could be having a lot of cardiovascular problems. So this is the same kind of thing, that it's more important about the within subject changes that could take place, although the between subjects should be somewhat informative because the dynamic is real. So that's why populations, for example, that have very high cholesterol levels statistically are far more likely. They're going to have higher percentages of heart attacks and strokes than populations that have less. But on an individual basis, it's not going to be so useful as a predictor. Okay?
Oh, I see.
So that's what's happening there. But it's interesting, and the same thing will be true of the females, but I'm not surprised. So it would be interesting to look at the correlation coefficients between testosterone levels in a population of a sample of 80 people and where that lined up to certain personality characteristics, particularly, for example, disagreeable. I would be very interested in that correlation coefficient. I'm sure it's there, and I'm sure it's pretty solid correlation coefficient, but I'd be interested in knowing whether it's 0.3 or 0.6. I think, in other words, is it just a little modest correlation, or is it a pretty big one? You know, that somebody someday may figure that out. That's a good PhD thesis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the interesting part with this show is they were the scientist who was going to do the blood tests. He was saying, be careful, because this ends up getting, you know, pitting people against each other. And now there's no question, you know, if everyone believes that testosterone is the big, you know, indicator of status, then now there's no question where you stand. But from what you're saying, this can be.
You've got a little subgroup that thinks that's the end all be all indicator. You can influence that little micro social network. Yeah, exactly. That's like all the sweaty armpits amongst a bunch of grad students when you start doing the block design on a Wechsler intelligence test. Suddenly we've got the great objective measure that's going to measure who's the smartest, and everybody's all upset about it. When all we're talking about is a measure that's a modest correlation with anything. And so exactly. But, you know, that's all fun and games as long as people can keep it in the proper perspective.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah. What was interesting is the girl who had the most testosterone was actually 7 months pregnant.
Ah, That's very interesting. Yeah, so that, who knows? There's all kinds of cascading hormone processes that are going on, and we don't know why, and that could be a male child, and she could be androgenizing a male child for all we know. So I don't know how that works. Very interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear the hosts just talk about, oh, yeah, it's going to be Julie because she's always very bossy and dominant and is always telling everybody what to do. There's no question about it.
Turned out to be true. So
yeah,
the correlation coefficient is positive. We just don't know how positive. That's what it is.
Okay. And so do you know anything about testosterone in gay men? Do the gay men, you know, do you know if they have more testosterone on average, or is that known?
I do not know. I think that's a great question. I can't believe that it's not known because it should be known. I would assume that it would be pretty close to heterosexual men. If it's lower on average, I would expect that this would be a pair of overlapping bell curves that would be pretty close. I don't think that they would be a pair of bell curves that are very far apart. What's going on, and it could be that the differences in gay and straight men may not even exist as adults, but in fact may be only relevant when the brain is in process of development in utero. And so that very likely, we actually know that that's involved. So that it could be that it's that differences are involved there in how androgenized the brain is at that point. And then after birth, there may not be any differences that you subsequently see. So I don't know. Interesting question, and somebody should know if they don't.
Fantastic. All right.
All right.
Dr. Lyle, I think we'll, how do you feel about calling the show? And we'll do the future thing next week.
That sounds perfect. Sounds just great, Nate.
Excellent. So Dan and the two callers that called in, thank you very, very much for calling in. We really appreciate it. Again, callers take priority. So we'll go over what the future will look like next week. Dr. Lyle, as always, pleasure hearing you talk.
All right.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.